This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Picture this. Someone comes to you and asks, I'm planning to start a school. What curriculum should I use? I can bet you that most of you will suggest some curriculum which you think is a good one. However, if the same person comes to you and says, I'm planning to build a factory. What machinery should I get? You will never say buy Cummins or Wärtsilä or Volvo or Caterpillar. You will ask, what is the factory for? What are you planning to produce? Now think of the school as a factory. How many of us ask this question before we talk about curriculum, syllabus, teachers or anything else? What is the school for? What is your final product? Do we ask this question? And that's like asking, what machinery should we buy? How would you answer that question? Unless you know what they want to produce. Obviously, the machinery to produce aeroplanes is different from the machinery to produce t-shirts. So unless you are clear about the product, there is no way that you can answer any question regarding machinery and the rest of it. Who should I have? I want to hire people. What qualifications should I look for? And so on and so on and so on. None of those things can be answered unless we are clear about what is it that we are trying to produce. So I want to ask you, what is the goal of the school? What does the final product look like? What must he or she be able to do? Do you have that defined for your school? If you have defined it, who knows it? How do you monitor results? What are your metrics? Because the reality is that what you don't measure, you don't know. What you don't know, you can't control or guarantee. What you don't measure, you cannot improve. In the words of Michael Harry, the designer of Motorola's Six Sigma quality program, he said a wonderful thing. He said, if you want to see what someone values, see what they measure. If you want to see what someone values, see what they measure. And believe me, never were more wiser words spoken. To give you an example, we claim to value time and we say time is money. But we waste time, but we don't waste money. If you lose a $20 bill falls out of your pocket, you will feel the regret of that. But on an average, people spend between 4 and 6 hours on their phones, on social media and various things. And if you ask them, what did you get out of the 6 hours? We have no answer. So 6 hours of lifespan, which is irretrievable, doesn't bother us at all. Whereas $20, or say $100, which is replaceable, bothers us. So, what do we value? What do we measure? What do we have a sense of loss about when we lose it? Time or money? You see how powerful this is? Any business has two players. Business, organization, whatever you want to call it, has two players. Sellers and buyers, suppliers and consumers, providers and beneficiaries. My question to you is, who are your consumers? Who are your beneficiaries? Who are your buyers? The success of the business depends on how well the beneficiaries like the service or products. Successful businesses constantly seek customer, consumer satisfaction and opinion. In GE, which I have been working with from 1994, we used to call it VOC, Voice of the Customer. These would be meetings where customers, random customers across the world, were invited to come to that particular GE business and talk to GE executives about their experience in dealing with whatever GE business it was. The job of the executives was simply to listen respectfully, ask questions to clarify, and solve problems, never to justify or give excuses. Now all of this is recorded. It was a highly effective process, and I believe it was one of the major reasons for very high customer retention and loyalty. My question to you, school owners and teachers, is, do you do this? Who do you talk to? Do you have a voice of customer system? Who do you talk to? When did you do that last? What did they say? Did you record it? Then what changes did you make? What was the result of those changes? Why am I asking these questions? Not only because I am a consultant and I do this in the corporate world, but because what you don't measure, you don't know. What you don't know, you can't control or guarantee. What you don't measure, you cannot improve. Next question. Who is this for any school for? Children? Really? Then why do you have parent-teacher meetings? Where are the children in these meetings? And if they are present, what is their role? Let's make our schools truly for the children. Not use children as an excuse for owners and teachers and administrative staff and a whole host of others to make money in a way that's convenient and easy for them, not necessarily for the children. Let's create a system where the one who was getting paid to teach passes or fails for succeeding or failing to teach. We apply this rule in everything in life, except schools. The lives and careers of children are ruined because they had incompetent, disinterested teachers. But those teachers still get their salaries and increments at the end of the year, no problem. Is this fair? Or even moral? How can we sleep in peace? Here's a quiz. It's an easy quiz. What do you call a place where inmates come in and the gate is shut? They cannot leave until the gate is opened at the end of their time in the facility. Inmates are segregated by age, as if date of manufacture is the most important thing about a human being. They are seated in rows behind rows, so that the second row onwards, each inmate gets to look at the back of somebody's head all day long. Now, how inspiring can that be? Inmates are not allowed to speak at will or to anyone other than the authority, and that only after taking permission. They are not allowed to disagree. Dissent is seen as rebellion and treated accordingly. Every decision that affects the inmates is taken by the authorities, and the inmates are not consulted about any decision, even though every decision affects them. Any tendency to try to become independent, question authority, suggest improvements, promote responsibility is seen as evil and punished. In short, all life skills that are necessary to succeed in society, careers, marriage, like teamwork, conflict resolution, critical skills to scenario planning, communication, influencing, decision making, and leadership are not taught. And where they emerge, despite not being taught, are mercilessly, ruthlessly, brutally eradicated. The time of the inmates, while they are in the facility, is strictly regulated, with punishments for not following the rules, all of which are imposed upon the inmates without their voice or choice. What time they eat and sleep and play and work are all regulated and have nothing to do with whether they want to do any of those things at the stated times. Inmates are not even allowed the freedom to go to the toilet without the humiliation of asking permission publicly. Inmates spend specific periods of time in each activity and break, which they are informed about by ringing bells or buzzers. They and their teachers included are not considered responsible enough to look at a watch or look at a clock on the wall and go to the next class. Interestingly, nobody objects. That's the level of conditioning, where the person doesn't even consider himself to be worthy of being treated with respect. That's great for all dictators, because where there's no dissatisfaction, there can be no rebellion. Inmates are tested, supposedly for knowledge, by their ability to random recall discrete, disconnected bits of information during a specific time window. If someone is unable to recall a bit of information in that window, but does that 5 minutes after the bell rings, he has failed the test. Depending on the level of this test, it can mean the difference between life and death. This is called a test of knowledge, but in reality, it's a test of memory alone, without any understanding about how the bits of information are connected or can be used. It's an exercise in collecting dots, not in connecting them. Finally, during this test, if any inmate seeks help or responds to a call of help from another inmate, they are punished. Individual, even toxic competition is encouraged and rewarded, and teamwork is suppressed and penalized. What do you call this institution? What is the name for it? Some of you are saying school, some of you are saying jail. Both of you are correct. Our schools and corporate organizations, including corporate organizations, are the most totally autocratic systems in the world, which is why we have oligarchies masquerading as democracies and nobody to question this. None of this is surprising because it all begins in the schools, which are run on the lines of prisons. Naturally, all the oppressed therein have only one single goal in life, to be able to give it back, to be able to give orders instead of obeying them. The only system they know is the autocratic prison model, and they are all aspiring jailers. Talk to any corporate head about collaboration, employee participation, decision making, electing bosses instead of them being imposed on them from top down, encouraging dissent and questioning and all such symbols of self-respect and freedom, and you see a hunted look come into his eyes. And if you listen carefully, you can hear a whirring sound interspersed with squeaks. That is his terrified little brain desperately seeking escape routes from this highly threatening conversation. Incidentally, unless like me, you are also among the exalted ranks of the voluntarily unemployable, don't ask such questions or you will learn the meaning of the ejection seat, perhaps too graphically. Now, what kind of schools do we really need? To answer this question, let's look at society. Because schools are the birthplace of those who will mold and change and manage and rule society. So ask, before you ask what kind of schools do we need, ask what kind of society do you want to live in? What kind of society do you want to live in? And factor yourself into the equation because it is about you. Before we go there, let's be clear that education and schooling are two different things and not always compatible with each other. That's why Mark Twain said, "I have never let schooling come in the way of education." I have never let schooling come in the way of education. For those who understand Urdu, we have a word called Musakhaf, Sahib-e-Sakhafat. It used to mean noble, honorable, principled, learned, courageous, chivalrous, and all such qualities. Today, it merely means literate, can read and write. That's how we have gutted the whole idea of education. We have reduced it to a means of earning a living alone. Whereas education was supposed to be for life by creating responsible citizens, not merely as a means to earn a living. The thirst for knowledge, the freedom to seek it, and understanding how to apply the learning are all not a part of what we call schooling, and the results are painfully visible. Education is not the responsibility of schools and teachers alone, but must be a partnership in parenting between parents, teachers, and children. All three are stakeholders. The children are the biggest stakeholders, and they must have a say in what happens. Parenting cannot be outsourced. You can't pay someone to raise your children just like you can't pay someone to diet on your behalf. If it is yours, you raise it. The school is your partner, but only you are the parent. The teacher is not your substitute. She or he is your resource, your help, but only you are the parent. Jannah is beneath your feet, O mother, not the teacher's. And you, dear father, are the door of Jannah for your child, not the teacher. If you want the privilege, you must pay the price. Comes with the territory. Education must therefore create individuals who are noble, kind, compassionate, learned, disciplined, principled, have excellent manners, courage, the ability to think and analyze, to communicate, to lead by example, and aware of their accountability to the one to whom is our return. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Reading and writing and learning different kinds of information and so on is one facet of education. It's not its purpose. We must give importance to it because only as one of the elements of education, not to the exclusion of everything else. Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam focused on only two things in his tarbiyah of his sahaba. Those two guided every decision and action that they took. One, taqwa, developing taqwa. The purpose of education is to develop taqwa. Taqwa is the concern to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in everything we say or do without exception. Taqwa is not fear of Allah, but the fear of displeasing the one we love the most. The more we love Allah, the more we fear to displease Him. That comes from knowing Allah, having a relationship with Him, and being aware of His presence in our lives at all times. How do we develop that in our children? How do we measure progress? And since only a lighted lamp can light another, what's the situation with our own parents and teachers, our own taqwa? What are our metrics to assess ourselves? Just to give you one pointer, look at your income and what you eat. If these two are not halal, it doesn't matter what else you do, there is no taqwa to speak of. How can parents who earn haram and eat and feed their children haram expect to raise children who are muttaqoon? Ask yourself this question. Number two, developing akhlaq. Number one, developing taqwa. Number two, developing akhlaq. Taqwa is the foundation, it's the power source from where everything comes, and akhlaq is the manifestation and action of that. This begins with how we treat children and those who have less power than we do. As they see, so they do. Children listen with their eyes. They don't care what you say until they see what you do. If you treat them like they are incapable of being responsible, of self-regulation, of planning and executing those plans, incapable of working together in teams they form and pick leaders for, that is exactly what will happen. They will be incapable of all these things. This is called a self-fulfilling prophecy in psychology. You imagine something and it happens. I'm not against guiding. By all means, guide them. But there's a world of difference between guiding and directing. If you have a doubt, ask. What happens if they decide not to follow my guidance, but to arrive at the result by a different route? The goal is non-negotiable, but the route does not need to be. What happens if they ask why should they do this task and how is it likely to help them in life? If you can't answer that question, then ask why is that child learning that stuff? Why should the child learn what you want him to learn when even you don't know why? Akhlaq are tested in how we deal with conflict and difference of opinion. Can we disagree without being disagreeable? How do we treat dissent? Do we accept it, encourage it, and use it as an asset, or suppress it and treat it as rebellion and treason and destroy the dissenter? Which one do you do? I'm calling this point 2.1 because this is part of the same second point, which is developing akhlaq, and that is developing collaborative decision making. Majlis al-Shura. As we know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala decreed this in the Quran and Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam practiced it. We see evidence of this in major decisions like the Battle of Badr and the Battle of Uhud, where he consulted his Sahaba and he took their advice. And we see how he took the advice of his Sahaba in Sulh Hudaybiyah, our mother Umm Salama radiallahu anha, in a very critical matter, and in the Battle of Al-Ahzab, Battle of Khandaq, where he took the advice of Salman al-Farsi radiallahu anhu. We don't have the time to go into the details of all these wonderful incidents in the seerah, wonderful teaching stories, but look them up yourself, and sometime if there is an opportunity, I will tell you. Now, there are many other instances in the seerah, but these are enough, inshallah. The final culmination of this was in the fact that he did not nominate his successor, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. No matter our opinions about that today, the fact remains that he didn't name anyone. In my view, this was because of two things. One, he knew who they would pick, and that was the one he wanted to succeed him. And secondly, because he wanted them to come to their decision on their own, so that they would then support the successor. Sure, there was a risk that their choice may have been different from his, but that's the risk that every coach takes, and which is a test of his coaching. The coach is never on the field, but no coach worth the name will put untrained players in the field and expect them to win. And no coach will ever train his team in one game and expect them to play a totally different game, which they never learned, and in which everything they learned results in a penalty. Yet, that's precisely what we do in our schools. We condition children to unquestioning obedience, to blindly obey authority, never to decide anything on their own, but to bow in submission to whatever is imposed from on high, no matter how stupid, inconvenient, or unfair it may be. We train them and condition them to value internal competition, no matter how toxic, and distrust, and we punish collaboration and teamwork, to show up the faults of each other and to snitch on our colleagues. We teach them that friends and neighbors and colleagues must be suspected, and then we expect them to do the opposite of all this and create a society that is compassionate and equitable and just and non-discriminatory and collaborative and kind and caring. I mean, we expect them to stand up to oppression and to question authority. We expect them to vote good people into power and bad people out. In short, we expect from them the opposite of all that we taught and conditioned them to do. Sadly, we are very successful, so they are completely incapable of doing anything else. I know this is a sign of insanity, where you teach somebody something and you expect them to do the opposite. It's a sign of insanity. But tell me, on whose part is that? Who is the insane person here? Let me ask you, what do you think will happen if you give those who are affected by the rules, the children, the opportunity to make the rules? After all, that's what democracy and freedom is all about, isn't it? When are children supposed to learn to use democracy and freedom, to value it, to deal with problems that may arise, and to practice it responsibly? When? You are saying to yourself, okay, all this is very well, but where does this happen? Is this practical? Let me tell you a story. A true story. My story. It was 1990, and I was the manager of New Ambadi Estates in Kanyakumari district in Tamil Nadu in South India. That consisted of two estates, two factories, and a school. The Arunachalam Higher Secondary School was a co-educational school with 1,200 students and 75 staff. The students came from poor families who survived on subsistence agriculture and any manual labor they could get. In the evenings, almost invariably, the men would get drunk, and domestic violence was a major social evil. When these children encountered discrimination and ill treatment from teachers also at school, you can imagine what they did, what this did to their confidence and enthusiasm for learning. Education was their only lifeline out of that society, but sadly, they were not getting it, despite all the money that the trust which ran the school had invested in the school. The medium of instruction was Tamil, but English language was taught as a subject in the curriculum. The school was partially aided by the government of Tamil Nadu in the form of salaries for some subject teachers, while the trust funded everything else, including all capital expenditure to build and maintain all the buildings and infrastructure. When I first visited the school to take stock of what was in store for me, I saw that it was built on about 2 acres of land and had nice spacious classrooms with plenty of light and ventilation. But the walls were covered with graffiti, and the grounds were like a massive garbage dump with paper and plastic and trash everywhere. The children were in the dumps as regards academic work, to which the board exam results amply bore witness. But on their feet, they were very agile. A little observation showed me why. It seemed to me that the teachers operated on the principle that if you would get your hands on a child, you must beat him. You may say, well, why beat the child if he did nothing? The answer is, he did not do anything now, but maybe he did it earlier, or in future he might do it. So when you catch him, beat him. It's good for him. The relationship between teachers and students was adversarial, to put it politely. They were like enemies to each other. I spent a couple of days in the school trying to get as much data by direct observation as I could. Then I requested the headmaster to call a staff meeting for me to address. Now that is another story which I will not tell you just now, but after that meeting, I introduced the practice of a weekly staff meeting which I would attend. Now, strictly speaking, this was not what I would recommend to anyone in my position, because as the head of a school to whom the headmaster reported, because it's the job of the headmaster to get these things done. But after seeing what the state of the school was, I decided that he needed strong support, at least initially. So we would meet every Monday in the last class period. I did not want to detain teachers after school, as it would be difficult for them to take their normal public transport, their bus home. The meeting was work, and so we did it during normal working hours. They appreciated that, and that made the meetings more productive. Then I asked for a general student assembly, and I met the whole school. So after the usual spiel about improving the school and so on, I did two things which got them to sit up and listen. I introduced myself and I said, my name is Mirza Yavar Beg and I am the new correspondent of your school. I want to know what you think about this school so that we can make it a place that you love to come to. Then I asked them, I said, tell me, are you happy with the school? Are you happy with how the school is being run now? And there was total silence. Of course, I expected that, but total silence. They looked at each other, they looked at the teachers, they looked at me as if to say, do you think we are fools? Do you think we are fools? Do you think that you can talk all this stuff and we believe you and we tell you what we feel? Go fly a kite, man. Mr. Whatever your name is. I could see all this in the faces of those sitting in the front row. And I knew that they represented the others. So I said to them, I want you to elect a class representative who will be a member of the student council, which I am going to set up. So your class representative will represent you, so do this carefully. I am giving you 1 hour of free time starting now. I want the class representatives to meet me for our first student council meeting in 1 hour. I let them go. Now it's amazing how many things, mostly negative, that we believe, or at least our teachers and other adults believed then about children. I had not given them any instructions, these kids, about how to conduct the election. I'm not saying that it was done totally fairly or efficiently, or that every child had a chance to exercise his or her choice. All I knew is that whoever was elected in 1 hour was someone with innate leadership ability. It took a bit longer than 1 hour, but we had our first meeting. I set the ground rules. The student council, I told them, will be comprised of class representatives from each class who will be appointed for a period of 1 term, which is 4 months. This is so that as many of you as possible get to experience being leaders. Class reps can be re-elected for a second term, but then must sit out 2 terms before standing for election again. The student council will also have 3 teachers as honorary non-voting members. Their role will be purely advisory, to provide information and support for whatever the student council decides to do. I said to them, You don't need to follow their advice. But be sure to ask questions to understand fully what they want you to do. Then, if you still don't want to do that, if it still doesn't make sense to you, ignore it and do what you think is the best way to get the result you want. These teachers will change every 2 terms so that they can provide continuity to the new student reps which get elected every term. Then I said to them, the student council will decide how this school will be run. Any questions? Hands shot up. I was very happy because questions indicate interest. Sir, what do you mean how school will be run? Now, all this was done in Tamil. That was the language of the place, and so I speak Tamil fluently, so this was easy. Sir, what do you mean? How will the school be run? I said, I mean start and end times, holidays, class duration, whatever you want. It is your school, and from now on, you, and I'm talking to the kids, you will decide how it will be run. And remember what I asked you in the assembly. Are you happy with the school as it is? I said, I meant it, even if you did not believe me. Here is your opportunity to change whatever you are not happy about. Now, the strange looks all around. Some teachers looked at me as if, they looked at me with pity really. Some smirked. All looked highly doubtful. The students just deadpanned me, no expression. I knew what was going on. As I had done similar initiatives in the past in corporate organizations. And that's another story. The first response to all change initiatives is suspicion. It's very important to remember this. People find it difficult to believe that the people they have been dealing with for a long time can change their behavior completely. The solution is consistency and persistence. Announce what you are going to do and do it without worrying about reactions. Once people see you behaving in congruence with what you stated, they come around and they realize that you are actually sincere and they will start trusting you. But this takes time. And it's important for you as the change agent not to react to anything that they say or do. People listen with their eyes. They do not care what you say until they see what you do. In this case, the children had gotten used to being abused and treated without respect, and for them to believe that teachers would not beat them anymore and that they would not only be treated with respect, but here was the highest authority in the school, that's myself, telling them that henceforth the school would be run according to their wishes, was simply too much to swallow. So they waited and watched. So I said to them, are you happy with how the school is run now? You can tell us. You can tell me, all of us here, teachers and your headmaster and I, we want to know. And nothing will happen to you, no matter what you say. Nobody will get a prize and nobody will be punished. And I said, you have my word for it. So I got some tentative responses from the front rows. No, we don't like the school as it is. I didn't push. I didn't tell them to give me details about what they didn't like, and so I left it. I knew what they wanted to say, and I also knew that they won't say it. Not then. Not yet. That there was even this first response was not a credit to me, but showed me the desperate situation that the students were in. That needed the change. They needed the change. And I was determined that it would happen. So I said to them, good. Now you get to change that. Do what you think will make this school the best school in the state, in Tamil Nadu. That's what I want. Do you want that? Yes. In next week's meeting, I want you to suggest to me what you would like to change to make this school the best school in Tamil Nadu. I said, this is your goal. How to make this the best school in the state. I knew that for them, even to think of themselves like that was a stretch. But they started thinking of themselves and the school as theirs. And that was my whole goal was that if they start thinking of themselves and their schools as theirs, they would start taking pride in it. If that happened, the rest would be easy and inevitable. It all starts with a thought, which kindles desire, which produces the energy. Direct that into the channels of strategy and you achieve your goal. I told them that I would attend their weekly meeting, but they could meet as often as they wanted and at any time they wanted. I set some ground rules. I told them that if they identified a problem, I wanted them to think it through and suggest a solution that we could apply. I did not want them to become professional protesters. I wanted them to become problem solvers. So whatever problem they mentioned would be their problem, and who better than them to suggest the solutions? The second rule was that the syllabus was non-negotiable. That had to be completed. So if they wanted to take time off one day, they would have to work extra time on another day to complete the syllabus. Finally, I reiterated that they would be treated with respect, but that they should also treat teachers with respect. That meant that whatever they wanted to do, they would have to discuss it with their teachers and get their agreement. I would be happy to facilitate that discussion if they wanted me to, but that was their responsibility. We would not impose anything on them without their agreement, and the same courtesy would apply to the teachers. Everyone agreed. They didn't know how it would work in practice, but it sounded nice. Teachers also looked happier after hearing this. In the next week's meeting, I produced a map of the school grounds on which I had drawn lines to divide it into squares. I said to them, each square is for one class. It is your class totem. In Tamil, the word for garden is totem. I said, this is your totem. This is your class garden. Please pick the square you want and write your class name in the square. Every month, I am going to have a competition and will give a prize for the best kept totem, best kept garden. Kanyakumari district is a fertile place, and these children came from farmers' families. Almost overnight, the school got cleaned up. All the garbage disappeared and gardens were planted everywhere except the sports fields, which was my responsibility to maintain. The teachers also bought into the new spirit, and their skepticism turned into enthusiasm. 2 or 3 weeks into the scheme, in the weekly meeting of the student council, they asked me, the student reps, they said, sir, we want permission to come to school on Sunday. So I said, sure, I have no problem with giving you permission, but why do you want to come to school on Sunday? They said, we want to clean up these walls. They look very dirty. Now, what was all the graffiti? Who put the graffiti there? Themselves. I didn't tell them to clean it up. It was there. They said, can we come on Sunday, clean up the walls? So I said, fantastic, let's do that. I said, I will also come. And I said, I will provide you with the lime wash, with the whitewash, and we will clean and paint the walls, and then we will all have lunch together. My treat. They were delighted. And that's what we did. We spent the whole day cleaning up the walls and so on, painting it. And then we all had a nice big feed. Now things happened week after week. Change is gradual, even when it is driven strongly top down, like I was forced to do. Exam results improved dramatically because both teachers and students started to take pride in their work. The cherry on the cake was that in the annual science fair, AMM Arunachalam Higher Secondary School, Thiruvattar, was placed in the second place in the state of Tamil Nadu, for a school which was so bad that they were losing teachers and losing children. To be there was amazing. Let me answer this question, which I am sure is in your minds. Did the student council create a revolution? Did I have a teacher rebellion on my hands? Did I get assaulted or even mildly abused? None of the above. None of them. The reality is that people in authority live in fear. They think that they need to impose authority by force or the whole house of cards will collapse around their ears. The reality is that if you take people into confidence and show them how following your method will help them to achieve their goals, you will have trouble holding them back. You don't need to encourage them. You will have to put some brakes on them. AMM Arunachalam Higher Secondary School's teachers and students were no different. They wanted their school to be the best in the state, but they were caught in this cycle of negativity that a lot of us get caught into without realizing. My advantage was that I was new. I was not part of this morass of low self-esteem and deteriorating performance that they were stuck in. So I could institute changes more easily. The good thing was that once we had broken the ice, I had everyone's full cooperation and we never looked back. Let's ask what happens in our schools. As I mentioned earlier, if you want to see what someone values, see what they measure. What do we measure? What are the metrics we use? Do we measure taqwa and akhlaq? Do we even know how to measure them? Let me give you a quick sketch of how to develop these metrics. Take the value you want to measure, in this case taqwa. Then ask, what are the behaviors which will show that the person is behaving with taqwa? In which situations is taqwa likely to be tested? What must the person do in such a situation? Then note this down. Ask children to maintain a journal and note down what happens with them both internally and externally. What was the internal struggle they had and what were the thoughts and emotions and inhibitions that they had to overcome? And what did they say or do? How did they overcome those things? Finally, if it didn't go the way it should have, what was the learning? And what is the damage control they did? Let the parents and you, the teacher, also keep notes. Then periodically have a discussion with the child and his or her parents. Focus on the positive and reward the child. Use the negative purely as a teaching moment, not to punish or criticize. Likewise, for akhlaq, remember, it's a collaborative effort which is worth the time and trouble that it needs, because we are talking about transforming society and creating a legacy of honor for all of us. As they say in Africa, it takes the whole village to raise a child. And it is worth it, because that child will change the path of destiny for the world. You might say, is it all? Just two things? Only taqwa and akhlaq? I say to you, yes. Because values drive behavior, and behavior drives results. Taqwa is the core value, and akhlaq covers all behavior. The rest follows. Now you say, well, what about exams? How do we know what the children learnt if we don't test them? I didn't say don't test them. I said test them for knowledge, not for random recall. They are human, remember? Not silicon chips. Here is how to test for knowledge and not random recall. Instead of asking, state Archimedes' principle. Ask, please give one example where Archimedes' principle is applied and one example where you would apply it. If someone has forgotten Archimedes' principle, let them look it up. It doesn't matter. That doesn't matter, because in real life, they would be able to look it up. But how to apply it must come from them. Application is the real and only proof of learning. Everything is possible if you want to do it. So ask, do I want to change? I rest my case. Thank you.